Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin, Senior Vice President of Global Strategic Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are entirely unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Gentlemen, this is Richard Martin here with your Thursday edition of the Richard Martin Wake Up Call. Okay, well, I thought I'd start off today by giving some fairly detailed information about why it is that the depression that we're in right now will be orders of magnitude worse than the depression of the 1930s. I have actually mentioned this before, and I certainly am aware that some of you are already familiar with these arguments, but I think it bears worth repeating because as the things get worse, the voices of so-called reason will be telling you that things are going to turn round, either because the new president will come to office or because now we are close to the 2002 lows, which means that obviously we're going to go right back up again, then we'll of course come to the 1982 lows, and then to the 1974 lows. And each time there will be these massive bear market rallies in the stock market, and pundits that come out telling you that everything's going to be okay again. I must tell you that things are most definitely not going to be okay again. I think it's useful when you are talking to people, if you are of the same opinion, that you have some facts and figures to back that up with. And I think it might be a good idea, if you want to just jot down some notes here, it would help you to remember these rather salient points, which will come in useful as time goes by. First of all, in the 1930s, most people didn't even own homes, let alone underwater mortgages and home equity loans and property taxes and all the other costs of home ownership. There were no credit cards, of course. American households were not $14 trillion in debt. There were no 401k or IRA safety nets to vanish overnight and turn middle-class retirees into paupers. The U.S. had a trade surplus, not a $700 billion plus yearly deficit. The U.S. had yearly budget surpluses and was not $11.5 trillion in the hole. And it is true that millions of industrial jobs did lie dormant, but they hadn't been permanently outsourced. And America was an ascending nation with relatively little global competition. It's hard to imagine those things, and of course people won't be anxious to emphasize those facts. But if you think that the stock market, despite those relatively healthy statistics, managed to lose 87% of its value from top to bottom in the Depression, imagine how much worse it's going to be today with the stock market falling dramatically and the economy falling out of bed, clearly identifying the presence of the end of the Ponzi scheme rally. The credit, everything that has been the mainstay of people's existence economically and financially for the past 5 or 10 years, if not longer, has cracked. There's a man by the name of Jim Rawls, who's an author and a lecturer, and in fact a former U.S. Army intelligence officer, and he publishes a blog called survivalblog.com. And he actually sets out some pretty compelling reasons why the current economic downturn will be far worse than the Great Depression. He points out some further substantial differences. He indicates that America was a largely agrarian and self-sufficient society in the 1930s, whereas now just 1% of the population operating farms and ranches feed the other 99%. America was not heavily dependent on computing and communications, technology, grid power, and petroleum-based fuels. There were shorter chains of supply. Most food was grown within 100 miles of where people lived. America had a very small underclass that was dependent on charity or public welfare. Property tax rates were much lower, and license fees were also lower or non-existent, as were vehicle registration fees, etc. The majority of workers lived near their work. Most displaced workers were willing to accept lower-paying jobs, even doing hard physical labor. The entire nation was economically self-sufficient and could carry on without many or any imports. Far greater self-sufficiency at the household level, for example, domestic water wells, windmills, wood-burning stoves, home vegetable gardens, home canning, and so forth, represented the domestic economy of the United States. A much lower level of indebtedness, as we all know, both private and public. At the outset of the Depression, most families actually did have cash savings, which is something very few people are aware of. Now, of course, the United States is a nation of debtors. America had a sound currency, still backed by specie. You know, although FDR's administration seized most privately held gold in 1933, the currency was at least still fully redeemable in silver coinage until 1964. There was a lower percentage of corporate employment. There was less risk of huge layoffs that would devastate communities. Morally speaking, society was significantly more moral and still had compunctions and a prevalently law-abiding attitude. The population was homogeneous, largely sharing common Judeo-Christian values. A much larger proportion of society attended church regularly. America engaged in a much simpler, less extravagant lifestyle with tastes in cooking and entertainment that did not require large outlays of cash. Most families, if they owned a car at all, owned one, obviously with proportionately lower registration and insurance costs. And they all lived in smaller homes that were less expensive to heat. So you see, in the 1930s, it cost a lot less to live as a percentage of income, and people were willing and able and accustomed to making do without. When people lost their jobs, in many cases they didn't lose their homes because they were paid for. Many people could simply revert to a self-sufficient lifestyle and earn enough with odd jobs to pay their property taxes. So you see, the bottom line really is this. When America really gets to experience the second Great Depression, by whatever label they choose to give it, when you take into account the high level of debt and the system's dependence, there will be enormous rates of dislocation and homelessness. And with modern-day immorality and the prevalent me-first attitude, I have absolutely no doubt that riots and looting will absolutely explode. You know, on a more economic level, we've talked about this process of deleveraging. This is the process of what happens once the bubble has burst. And the bubble, of course, is a credit bubble where people will accept credit in payment for the various goods and services that we've all come to know and love. But as I've said to you on many occasions, when this thing turns round and the credit implodes, then you have a process known as deleveraging, which means unwinding the credit. You know, we think that that means that, you know, banks, consumers, companies, and the government just have to cut down their debt a bit. Unfortunately, it's a lot worse than that. Because unless it's different this time, banks, consumers, companies, and the government are going to need to cut their debt by more than half, to about $20 to $25 trillion from the current $51 trillion. And that's a lot of buying power that's going to go poof. You know, from the early 1920s through 1985, the average level of debt to GDP, that's debt to gross domestic product, in other words, how much proportion of debt this country had in relation to its output of goods and services domestically, what we call debt to GDP. It's an interesting statistic because you get to see how much people actually had in terms of credit, not on a personal level, but as a direct proportion of the output and services, the total output and services of the country known as GDP. And the average level of debt to GDP was 155% between 1920 and 1985. And the highest peak in history, the peak of this, and that was the average, remember, the peak, which actually was the highest in history until the recent debt boom, was in the early 1930s when debt to GDP soared to 260% of GDP. Now thereafter, in the 1930s, that ratio then cratered to 130%, and it remained close to that level for another half century. But then in 1985, Americans started to borrow, and last year, when the borrowing came to an end, effectively, Americans had borrowed 350% of GDP. See how monumental that is in historical terms. Now, if we wanted to go back to the 155% average GDP of the 1920s to the 1980s, that requires getting rid of more than $25 trillion of debt. How is America going to do that? You know, I don't know the answer to that question. It is likely that that will actually happen. It's not required to happen, of course, but it's very likely to happen because that level of 150, 155 does seem to be a kind of natural level where society hums along nicely and people get wealthy and, you know, the capitalist system seems to thrive. Now, of that $25 trillion of debt, do you have any idea how much has been written off so far? What if I told you $650 billion? Not even $1 trillion, just more than half a trillion. And we'd have to go through $24.5 trillion of debt. Somehow America has to find a way to get rid of $24.5 trillion of debt additional to what has already been lost from the system in recent weeks and months. Do you begin to understand the severity of the problem, ladies and gentlemen? Are you beginning to get it that this is a catastrophe of unparalleled proportions. It will take years to achieve this. All right, so let me quickly give you my information. It's Richard Martin here at the helm with Richard Martin's Wake Up Call, coming to you live and kicking from Miami, Florida, through the good offices of the Progressive Radio Network studios in New York City. We have a studio phone number call-in for you to use, and hopefully you'll do so, because we love to hear from you. The number to call, toll-free, if you'd like to ask a question, is 888-873-4643. So let me repeat that for you, please. 888-873-4643. That will take you straight to our engineer, who will ask you to hold, and I will be informed through the wonders of modern technology, and I will then let you know when we are ready to take your call at an appropriate break in the proceedings. All right, now you can also email your question in, and you can do that by emailing the following address: rmartin@gscorporation.com. Let me repeat that. The GS stands for Global Strategic. The word corporation needs to be written out in full, and I will read it once more. rmartin@gscorporation.com. And finally, if you would like to ask me a question in private or to air a rant or a grievance, you may certainly do so by calling my direct line on 305-357-5575. I'll repeat that once more. 305-357-5575. Okay. Well, as we did on Monday, I'm going to spend most of the rest of this session answering your questions. They've been building up. They build up, and they're interesting questions, and they're yours, and this is your program, so I take them very seriously. I like to deal with them as a priority, so we will do that in just a moment. I just wanted to recap a little bit on what has happened recently in kind of Wall Street terms, so that you really get to understand where we really are in terms of the financial situation as it was until just a few months ago. Obviously, you appreciate that we had a Ponzi finance situation on a grand scale. The more markets perceived a new era of endless cheap finance and rising asset and commodities prices, the more U.S. and global credit systems created the necessary inflationary fuel to perpetuate the bubble. Markets believed the hedge funds and private equity game could go on indefinitely. Participants thought that Wall Street would securitize loans and be in a position to expand finance forever. Prime brokers would always be willing outlets to finance leveraged securities holdings on the cheap. And, you know, while we still are close to that period, it pays to reflect a little bit on what that really meant. This is something that we had taken for granted, at least perhaps not listeners to Richard Martin's wake-up call, but in general, people just assumed these things. They assumed that house prices would only ever go higher. They assumed that oil would always be freely and plentifully available at modest prices, much lower, by the way, than in the rest of the developed world. People just assumed that they could get loans at will and pay them off whenever they felt like it or not, as the case may be. This was the prevailing thinking. In years to come, people will write books. They'll look back and they'll look on this period as a period of absolute, utter, total madness, the likes of which the world has never seen. Now, we're not there yet. We're not sufficiently distanced from that period. But I assure you that that's how it will be seen. People will make fun of this period. They will actually mock the perpetrators of these ridiculous financial schemes in years to come. So bear that in mind when you think about these absurd derivatives, which were considered always to provide an efficient and effective marketplace for placing bets. I mean, they were nothing more than bets. We know that now. You know, bets go wrong. And when they go wrong, somebody has to stand behind the other side of the bet. You know, and all these other hedging myriad risks. Why not speculate aggressively when insurance was so easy to come by? At the same time, contemporary repo and money markets were viewed as an endless source of inexpensive finance. And as soon as anything unexpected happened, the U.S. Federal Reserve would always insure liquid markets and inflate as required. Again, why not speculate? The markets had unwavering faith in enlightened contemporary finance and central banking. And now, of course, with the Fed still trying to perpetuate the same old mindset through throwing money and liquidity at a problem which needs money, like a hole in the head. I mean, they're still doing it. They haven't learned. They haven't understood that they're just playing the final act in what clearly and indisputably has to be seen as the greatest mania in human history. And you know, as it turned out, the markets could not have been more wrong on the sustainability of the financial backdrop, the economic environment, asset price inflation, all types of sophisticated financial structures and strategies. You know, markets were not only absolutely wrong, they were absolutely wrong on so many things on such an unprecedented global basis. Well, now, of course, things are blowing up. All these games and financial shenanigans are broken. And as a result, Wall Street simply no longer has the wherewithal to apportion ample finance for securities speculation. And of course, without speculative demand for high-yielding loans and securities, bubble economies are starved of sufficient finance. And with asset markets bursting everywhere, this has quickly evolved into history's biggest margin call. You know, scores of derivative structures used to speculate in the asset bubbles have collapsed because of counterparty issues, or illiquidity, or the structures didn't make any sense to begin with. And we've discussed those often enough, ladies and gentlemen. Moreover, the whole notion that derivatives would provide an effective hedging mechanism is proving a fallacy. You know, as always, these counterparty issues and illiquidity are the culprits. Markets cannot hedge themselves, as there's no one with the wherewithal to take the other side of the trade, especially during devastating bear markets. The credit default swap structure is right now proving an unmitigated disaster for bond markets, for equity markets, currency markets, in every form of derivative play. These derivatives are crashing down to earth and causing untold devastation. And I'm afraid that this period of liquidation will not be over for a very long time. Well, okay, let's have a look at some of the questions. I just got in a question a few seconds ago from somebody who describes himself as a devoted listener without a name, and they write as follows. We have a home equity line used one half and have the other half $100,000. It is less than 5% interest. Shall I put it in a higher interest locked in as a home equity loan? Will home equity lines of credit increase? We live in upstate New York. Our house is paid for. Bought another small place to fix up and sell. My husband has the skill of improving our home, and my work is stable. Thanks for your help. A devoted listener. Really, I don't think you're going to get a higher interest rate than 5%. Mrs. Devoted Listener, not in a low or no risk environment. It's going to be a lot less. In fact, I'm wondering where the 5% comes from, unless it's an old CD or something like that. I would not take out any further loans. I think you are most ill-advised to do that, or to draw down on any further amount of money. The house, you say, is paid for. Your husband improves the home and presumably the second property that you bought. You have a job. Don't test fate. Don't try to overcome this. This is a time to be very modest in your ambitions. You've got to survive. That's really priority number one, is survival at this point. Okay? So no, I wouldn't do any of those things. All right. We have another email just came in from Richard Silvan. Dear Richard, I'll read the email. I'm a relatively new listener to your show, which has educated me and helped me immensely. I thank you, and I'm greatly indebted. I am essentially economically illiterate. I have never paid attention to the stock market, money market funds, etc. Only recently I have been asked to help with my father's portfolio, so I am working diligently to educate myself, so please excuse my ignorance. I find the economic crises we find ourselves in today quite fascinating as well as scary. It seems so ridiculous and simple how the whole economic house of sand collapsed. A little while ago you mentioned several steps that must be taken to solve this problem. Among them is an abandonment of government-sponsored enterprises, phasing out of fractional reserve lending, a return to a strong currency backed by gold. If that is the case, then it seems that the professionals, quote-unquote, in Washington, charged with trying to solve this problem are doing all the wrong things. If they are then, how is it possible that the economic crises could ever be fixed? Also, what is the possibility of ever going back to the gold standard? I do believe we were off it temporarily during the Great Depression. And one last question, if I may, and it pertains to one of the steps mentioned above about government-sponsored enterprises. What was the New Deal's effect on the Great Depression? Thank you for your show. Well, let's work backwards. The New Deal's effect on the Great Depression was actually a grave negative, because it took away all the incentives to work, it took away all the incentives to build businesses, it threw credit onto the fire, it made people dependent on the state, all things that the United States never said it lived for, it never signed up for those things. So actually, we were not able to see it at that time, but anybody who could see forward into the future could have predicted all the things we're seeing today, basis the New Deal. The country didn't need a New Deal. It just needed a cleansing of the system from all the old bad malinvestments and a restart. And it never got it. And this is one of the sad and tragic elements of what we are going to have to deal with today. Part of your question, all these things that were being done or not being done, the abandonment of government-sponsored enterprises, phasing out fractional reserve lending, return to strong currency, indeed those are not being done. The problem is not being solved, and the economic crises will never be fixed through the solutions offered by the government, which have nothing to do with sound economic practices. So it isn't how they will be solved. They will not be solved, not in that way. Of course, that's going to drag the depression on for much longer than otherwise it needed to be. I'm glad you find the economic crises fascinating. I mean, I do too, Richard, and I'm glad you're interested in it. And I do think that you're right. It is ridiculous that the whole economic house of cards had to collapse. And it certainly didn't have to. So, thank you for your question, and learn from history. So then Michael Reidinger comes in and says, "Welcome back, Richard. Thanks for helping us be in a position for October's downhill sled. Do you have any sense about shorting retail stocks for the holidays coming? I.e., will they bump up before they drop when the results are in? I appreciate your work, Michael R." Holidays, elections, summer solstices, Thanksgiving, trick-or-treat, none of these things have anything to do with the stock market whatsoever, Michael. It is one of the primary lessons you need to understand. They are only used by the pundits because they have no idea what makes the stock market go up or down. So they latch onto these stupid events. They might just as well say when it rains more than 6 inches, the market will go up, 50 points. They have no idea. And so they latch onto all these ridiculous economic fundamentals and make it seem as though the stock market sort of dances to their tune. They absolutely don't. So don't worry about holidays coming. Any other factors other than what plays into the element of supply and demand. That is the only thing that will make a stock market move, is supply and demand for stocks. Nothing else. Nothing else will do it. All right. Those are the current questions of today. Now we go back in time a little bit, and I apologize, as we do actually go back, and some of these questions date back quite a while, so I'm only just getting to them right now. Lilius Gregg sent me an email on the 27th of October saying, "Dear Richard, I listen to you on the Internet. You are great. Great to have access to you. What is your opinion of the purchase of gold and silver at this time? Please advise, Lilius." I don't believe that these commodities are going to assist you in gaining wealth. I mean, I think that they are assets. I've said this many times before. They are bona fide assets, just like any others. We are in a period of very searing deflation. Deflation means, the definition of deflation doesn't mean this, but in effect, deflation requires that prices go down, the prices of assets go down, and gold and silver are assets. They are not tied to anything. They have no privileged place in the economic scheme of things, and therefore, I'm afraid they are subject to the vagaries of asset prices during deflation. And it doesn't take a genius to tell you that they go down, and down they are going. Gold is down $14 today. Silver is down 5 cents. Wouldn't touch them. Sorry, Lilius. I hope that's not... I hope that's, the answer that you did want to hear, meaning that you don't have any of these things already. Rinder Cote, or Cote, wrote in saying, "Dear Mr. Martin, I enjoy your program on PRN. I don't understand everything, but I do listen and try my best. My question is, are CDs through banks still safe?" Answer, Rinda, yes, they are. "I have a year CD, and I'm wondering if I should just take the money out of the CD and out of the bank as well. I don't make money due to disability, but what I got from the government, I put in a CD. Should I not put my money in the bank anymore?" No, don't worry about it. Up to $250,000, you are covered, Rinda. Not a problem. And I fully support your holding of a CD. Then we come to Michelle Cameron, who writes, and she wrote back on October the 10th, so I'm afraid I've been gathering these things, I've been gathering dust for a while, some of these emails, but anyway, she writes, and the subject is work retirement funds. "Hi, Richard. I missed a few of your shows, so I'm writing to ask if I should leave my 403B pension in the traditional account it is in now, or take it out and put it in a CD or money market in the bank. Thank you, Michelle Cameron." Michelle, in order to answer your question, I need to know what menu of choices you have in your 403B pension plan. So if you would like to get in touch with me and let me have a list of those choices, I will then be able to answer you coherently. My feeling is that you may very well not have an adequate list of choices, but I won't know until you tell me. So I can't answer that question. And, of course, that question applies to anybody else who's wondering what to do about their 401Ks or 403Bs. If you have any doubts, let me know. I'll try to help you. But in principle, all your money should be in Treasury Bill money market funds. That's to say, money market funds, where not only are they labeled Treasury Bill money market funds, but they actually contain Treasury bills. Often it's this bait and switch thing. They tell you it's Treasury bills. You look inside the holdings of the fund, and then you find some 80% in government-sponsored enterprises and some nonsense like that. Check the holdings of your funds, ladies and gentlemen. Make sure your Treasury bill funds contain nothing but treasury bills. I know that sounds ridiculous to say, but, you know, nothing is ever what it seems in this world, is it? All right. I think the time has come to go to Steve Kruger and his rant, and that is what I shall do. I received it at 9:23 a.m. this morning, so it's fresh off the brain of said Steve, and it is entitled Constitution? What Constitution? And here goes. Richard, this is something I noticed over the last 2 weeks, and I'm wondering if you also picked up on it. Being in Europe for 3 weeks, it might have got past you. Let me start with World War II, a war declared by Congress, fought on two fronts, 12 miles apart. I think you mean 12,000 miles apart, Steve. Okay, 12,000 miles apart against 2 1-million-man-plus armies, and we declared victory in under 4 years. Today, we fight an undeclared war in Iraq against an uncounted army which doesn't even own a single uniform, and we have taken 5 years to reach this point. We have been told by our leaders from the start that we will be fighting this for a very long time. Even presidential hopeful John McCain says he's willing to stay in Iraq for 100 years. Now, 2 weeks ago, Fox News and to a lesser degree CNN News have been reporting how well the war is going, saying a remarkable change is taking place and that the troops might be coming home sooner than they thought, and that the handoff to the new Iraq government is going so smoothly they find it hard to believe. Well, Richard, I too find it hard to believe when you consider that we've given up a good part of our Constitution. I have to think that our fine leaders are planning to use the 150,000 troops now in Iraq to police our streets in the event that our collapsing financial system does go down for the count. I do see this coming in a 12-month time frame. Have you any thoughts on this? Thanks for wake-up call, Steve Kruger. Well, Steve, I have always said that I try to restrict myself to financial matters, but I will make a small exception in this case, because this brings up something which is connected to my important announcement that I said I was going to make in the next few weeks. And it does indeed concern the social state of this country in the future. And I do think there are very powerful reasons to think that there will be a total breakdown of law and order at some point. And I think your fears are justified. I happen to know that one platoon is already being trained for the eventuality of social unrest. This has never happened in this country before. I read about it just before I left on vacation back a month ago. And it is very serious and a very unfortunate predicament, and I shall be gathering together material in support of my arguments as time goes by. But yes, I fully believe that troops will be retrained for national civil unrest, and so we will talk a lot more about that in the weeks to come. Thank you for the rant, Steve. Enjoyed it, as always. Let's go now to E41. Who writes, and this is back on October 17th, in reply to a claim that speculators cause price rises, well, they can and do, but only when they actually hoard the commodity in question and or intentionally try to stop production to drive up the price. Otherwise, a speculator ultimately has to sell, dropping the price. The food markets are sufficiently large so that no one can come close to monopolizing them. The commodities markets are designed to transfer risk to those willing to hold it for a buck from those who are unwilling to take the risk. Note, by the way, speculators do not cause price inflation. They merely interpret supply and demand, but are not infallible or we'd all get rich quick. They are necessary in a free market to try and direct capital according to their interpretation of supply and demand. Oil speculators the world over, working with all available data, determine what price oil should trade at in a free and open market. Speculators do not cause the price to rise. Perceptions pertaining to news about supply and demand cause the price to constantly change and at times to trend upward or downward. Please understand this. Oil prices will never be cheap again. All known available light sweet crude has been used. Only heavier sour grades are thought to remain. There's plenty of it, but it is both more costly to extract and to refine. Finally, without a doubt, one of the very greatest drivers of high prices in the U.S. is our own foolish government policies enacted by liberals, which have made most of our own energy sources and the means of processing them unlawful. The cause of high U.S. energy prices is walking the halls of Congress, and Jim McGovern and Barney Frank are among them. If you voted for them, then you are partly to blame for your own high energy costs. And these are the very same people who want to blame speculators. It is a very sad joke, and nobody's laughing. Well, thank you, E for One. The first thing I would like to point out is that on October the 17th, when you wrote that email, the price of oil was $74 a barrel, and it has lost 50% of its value from the 140-150 price level that it was at 4 months ago. So prices do go up and down, and they go up and down rather dramatically, and it isn't altogether a question of any one factor, E for One. Now, speculators, I remember when the price was high, we were all told how terrible speculation was. The speculators should be stopped. The speculators should be banned. The speculators were evil beings who came down from outer space to curse the world and all that therein lay. Nothing could be further from the truth. I tried to fob you off that attitude, if you remember, ladies and gentlemen, way back in the summer, to inform you that, in fact, speculators were a good thing for markets, because not only did speculators buy when markets went up, but they sold short when markets came down. Moreover, every speculator has to cover his position. So they are really, in effect, a meaningless operational influence on the market, although, of course, they do have their day and they can make a lot of money. Speculators, as you rightly point out, E for One, interpret supply and demand, which I rather like that expression, actually, and they're certainly not infallible, as you say. I wouldn't be too quick to rush to judgment as to what causes prices to go up and down. There are all sorts of factors. You see, remember that if you actually knew for sure what caused prices to go up or down, you could become a speculator yourself, E for One, and play on those elements and make a lot of money. But markets make very sure that no one person ever does have a handle on why things happen, and therefore it becomes extremely difficult to actually make money through a monopoly of correct thought, if you like. Okay, thanks for the email. We have a caller, George, from Manhattan. George, hi, how are you?
Mr. Martin, how are you? Just the first question on that troops. Are we talking food shortages and food riots?
Yes, among other things, we are. Most certainly, yes.
And how many... Do you know offhand how many divisions they're training?
One so far, but maybe that's just a trial training. I don't know, but they will train more. I am convinced of it. In fact, I'm quite certain that the whole of this national security division, Homeland Security, is to do with the control of domestic crowds. It has nothing to do with terrorism. I mean, look how much terrorism we've had in this country since 9/11. It doesn't make sense. Why should they put this whole country to the indignity of all these things? If in fact we've had one terrorist catastrophe, during this period. There are other things going on, George. We don't know what they are, but I assure you they have to do with national security coming from within, as opposed to without, quite certainly.
I totally believe you. What should we be doing as citizens now to protect ourselves, food-wise?
Well, be good. Be a good citizen. I mean, basically, I know that sounds ridiculous, But, you know, and many people don't realize this, but when they had those riots in South America back in the 70s, whether you want to believe this or not, you can ask anybody who actually lived in, I'm talking about privileged people, let's say very privileged, wealthy people in these countries, who didn't mess around. In other words, anybody who lived really well, who didn't create trouble and didn't go into communist cells and try to create disturbances of one sort or another, had actually nothing to fear from these governments. They left you alone. The problem was so many families, wealthy and influential families, had the kind of so-called rogue son or daughter who wanted to do well by the world and who was infused with a sense of socialist justice and kind of, you know, would go and join the communist infiltrators. Those were the people who disappeared. You know, but I'm not really concerned with that issue, although it will come up. I'm certain that that will be an issue in the fullness of time. I'm much more concerned with just the idea that people simply are not going to have enough to eat, and they're not going to have anywhere to live. There's problems which are much more practical and down to earth than that. And so when you say to me, George, what should we do? The answer is just follow the instructions, as it were, that I gave you from time to time about, you know, being self-sufficient. This is not the time to be loading up on food or anything like that, because you're going to get plenty of warning, just like we had plenty of warning of the financial meltdown. But it does behoove you to be aware of what is potentially out there and you know, how the levels of society could break down and probably will because of the immense disparities between rich and poor, which are growing even as we speak and will continue to grow, more particularly as the poor suddenly become poorer rather than because the rich suddenly become less or more wealthy. We will discuss this, and I actually prefer to discuss it more in terms of where we're getting to. In other words, where we have certain evidence, like that caller or the email writer that wrote to me a few days ago saying, you don't give me enough evidence, it all seems to be very general. And it's true, I like to have more hard and fast evidence to report to you, ladies and gentlemen, when I come out with my views and opinions. Because just to throw things out in the air like that isn't very useful and it isn't very credible. Thank you, George, for the question. I mean, it's well taken, and certainly as time progresses, we'll talk much, much more about that.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We had a Carolyn Heath came in with an email just now saying, Richard, with the eventual collapse of the financial system, won't business schools have to reassess and reevaluate what they've been teaching in our business schools? Just a thought.
Uh-huh.
Thanks, Carolyn. Yes, indeed they will, Carolyn. Absolutely well taken. Business studies with a financial concentration will all but disappear, in my opinion. You're going to be talking much more about the basic elements of running a business as it used to be. People will not be running out of business school straight onto Wall Street. They will be going into business either in the management capacity or else maybe building their own independent businesses, but business schools will indeed have to change dramatically. I also think they'll have to change the kind of philosophy that they use to describe what makes successful business, because I don't think that the unfettered capitalist philosophy that we've all got so used to in the last 50 years will cut it anymore, Carolyn. So, yes, I do, and thank you very much for the question. Very well taken. Caller Joe. Hello, Joe. You are on the line. What can we help you with today?
I was wondering if you would be shorting the Dow at this point, the diamonds at this point, with the election coming up next week.
Thank you, Joe. I don't believe, I mean, any of these yardsticks like elections or, as I said earlier in the program, you know, Thanksgiving or Christmas or Uncle Joe's birthday or anything like that, Joe. No, I don't think these things are relevant to markets. Markets operate and thrive. They breathe in and out, and it's entirely a function of supply and demand. And until you get to grips with what is happening in the world of supply and demand, you can't really expect to adequately analyze the markets. I don't think you will be served by using the election or anything else in terms of what to do. It's pretty obvious that Obama is going to win. Everybody knows that. The market operators know that. I assure you, when you wake up on November the 5th, there's not going to be much that's different from 4 p.m. on November 4th. So that's the short answer. There's a lot more that one could say, but I think that that probably does it for now for you. If that's okay, will that suffice for you, Joe? Joe's gone. Okay. Well, thank you for the question. Now we come to Bruce Horner, who on October the 14th wrote me an email saying, "Hi, Richard. I try to listen to your progressive radio show faithfully, and I enjoy it very much. I heard you talk in the past about bank ratings, and I misplaced the website where to locate Save. Please advise the site and how often do they upgrade ratings." The site, Bruce, is thestreet.com. Once again, thestreet.com. That is a site which bought out Marty Weiss's ratings, very successful ratings business, which I was sorry to see that happen, but and they did. If you go to thestreet.com, you can navigate through to where you will get an appraisal of bank ratings for any bank of your choice. You just put the name of the bank in the box, and they will give you the opinions they have on that. So that's the answer to that. Second question, where do you advise keeping your savings accounts if they exceed government protection? Should one open a Canadian account? Thanks for your input. Regards, Bruce Horner. Nope. What I think you should do, Bruce, is buy treasury bills or just leave them in a treasury bill money market fund. I don't think you need to open up a Canadian account. Now, if we decide that we think that the dollar is going to collapse, that might be a good reason to open up a Canadian account. But just in order to protect money which exceeds the government protection, the FDIC protection, I think that's overkill. I don't think you need to do that. Just buy treasury bills or treasury bill money market funds, which your broker should be able to direct you towards. Okay, I have a call from somebody who I know, but who chooses to call himself anonymous. And he says, "Hello, Richard. If the U.S. one day returns to the gold standard or silver standard, what effect will that have on the price of those metals? And also, what effect will that have on the dollar in relation to other currencies?" The answer to that, and by the way, you wrote the same email twice. No problem. The answer to that, anonymous, is that it should stabilize the currencies, and it should it should stabilize the price of the metal, because obviously if you return to the gold standard, that means that the dollar will be quoted against that metal at a particular price. So probably it won't be $35 an ounce, but it might be $350 an ounce or $842 an ounce. Basically, it will simply organize the money supply such that it cannot exceed the amount of gold in storage quoted at that particular price. So the price of gold will stop moving, and the price of other currencies will become much more calm in deference to the newly defined price of gold against the dollar. So I think that tends to answer your question, Mr. Anonymous. As always, if there's anything else I can help you with, don't hesitate to let me know. All right. Let's take another email, one that came in from Valerie, who says, who wrote in on October the 23rd and said, "Dear Richard, recently, I opened 529 college accounts for my grandchildren, age 2 and infant. It is recommended to put the contribution into an age-appropriate stock portfolio." Ouch. Valerie, I'm reading this for the first time, but already I am cringing, and I have not much more of this to go, so I hope I'm not going to read what I think I'm going to read. On we go. "It seems that this would be a bad time to invest in stocks. The IRS allows you to change the direction of the account once a year, so I hoped you might tell me what would be a better option. I know we are all happy to have you home. Thanks, Valerie. Well, congratulations, Valerie. You didn't do what I was very fearful that you might do. The recommendation clearly is nonsense. I don't know when this recommendation was given, but hopefully the market has indicated the value of that recommendation, for which you probably paid nothing, and is valued at same. I don't know what else you have to choose from, Valerie. I do think you might want to get in touch with me personally about this if you are interested. But as always, I think your best bet is just a fully defensive stance in Treasury bills and maybe CDs if you have a longer time frame, which it appears you do since the children are very young, give you a little bit more interest. But nothing else. No creative strategies for you today. Right. Then I get an email from Beau, just came in. Very quick. Diamonds look oversold. Do you agree? For November? Beau, I'm really sorry. I must tell you, I do not follow the diamond market at all. I have no idea what it does. It's extremely volatile and extremely unpredictable. I've always heard people say, you know, they never had any success of trying to trade it, so I suggest you don't do so either. That's about all I can tell you. I'm sorry, no more information than that. Okay. Suzanne Wilson wrote in on October the 23rd saying, "Hi, Richard. I am single with a partner. I'm 59 years old. I have transferred in the last few months my IRAs, mutual funds, to an annuity, Sun Life, for 5 years, feeling it was safer. I also transferred my TIAA CREF with my current job from stocks to TIAA CREF traditional. I also own a co-op, No Mortgage in New York, which is rented. Any suggestions?" Yes, sell the co-op and sell the mutual funds. Sorry, but you are very, very severely overextended and very vulnerable, Suzanne. I'm glad you're talking to me about this now as the market's coming up and maybe giving you a little bit of an opportunity to get out, but I think you're being badly advised. I don't think there's any value to owning investment property in New York City any more than I think it's a value to be owning stocks. So just liquidate them. That's all I can say. Bill Adamo. Bill, I still don't know how to pronounce your name. Is it Adamo or Adamo? One of these days I will find out. I am sorry. Bill, I'm reading your email from October the 24th in which you say, "Richard, stocks, commodities, credit is deflating. When will we start seeing deflated prices in everyday things we buy in stores? Food, clothing, appliances, construction, trade costs, etc." Bill. Well, Bill, the answer is you are starting to see these deflated prices. Food, in many cases now, is being heavily discounted. Clothing is really heavily discounted. I mean, I'm sure you've seen this. You go into any mall of your choice, and you're going to see store after store with 50% off the whole store, and, you know, clothing prices are collapsing. Appliances, likewise, much, much cheaper than they were this time last year in general. I'm not familiar with construction trade costs, but these things don't all happen at the same time. You know, you've seen the price of houses collapse. Cars are collapsing, both new and used cars. Oil prices have collapsed. You know, these things happen bit by bit. You know, the commercial real estate took a long time to follow residential real estate, but it's going down the tubes now. Things happen piecemeal, Bill, and they will happen. You just have to be patient. I hope they won't take too long to satisfy you. Luba. Luba from New Jersey wrote in a quick email saying, "Dear Mr. Martin, I have lost 26% of my 401k, which I don't need for another 10 years. what is your opinion about cashing out now and cutting my loss? Or wait until there's a gain in the market now and slowly withdraw? Or just keep it in my account with the hopes that the market will recover over the 10-year period before I need the cash? Many thanks for you and your show. Well, Luba, you've lost, let's say you've lost 26%. This is not very, very serious, but it's definitely serious enough for you to extricate yourself immediately from that 401k stock investment. Again, go into the money market. Try to persuade your administrator to organize a treasury bill money market fund, but do liquidate those stocks. The fact that you don't need it for another 10 years is always the argument they use to tell you to stay in the market, to weather the storm, to ride out the valleys, or whatever the cliche is. In reality, think about how much more stock you could buy today. Just today, with a 26% loss, with the saved money that you might have liquidated, say, a year ago, with 100% of the value of the money you put in. I mean, it's quite considerable, but that amount is going to increase dramatically. So the idea is take the money out now, Luba, and keep the money in cash or in a money market fund, ready to reinvest at much lower levels several years down the line. And don't be concerned about doing nothing. Who cares if you make nothing for 3 years, 0%, and then you make maybe 150% in the fourth year? You know, these are things that people need to understand, that investments don't always pan out according to, you know, instructions. You have to give them the time they take to play themselves out. So, as I say, get into cash now, allow the deflation to take it to play its course, and then go back in 4 years' time or 3 years' time. Hopefully I will still be around. I will give you some guidance in that regard for the next ride-up. But don't play these bear market rallies. They are vicious, they are brutal, and they are fatal, because as often as not, they turn around and they go back down, and you're left holding stocks that you never should have bought in the first place. Do we have time perhaps for one more question or email? Hoping that we do. We are going to take the email from Sarita Alitovsky. Sarita Alitovsky wrote in on October the 23rd saying the following: Dear Richard, way back in February, you gave a talk that made a powerful impression on me. You gave some woman advice as to selling her apartment in New York City. Her name was Catherine. Later, you and I spoke, and I requested that this woman contact me. I had asked you to find this lady for me to thank her for asking you the question of what to do with an apartment in New York. You had said something to the effect of sell and save yourself. I never did get to speak to that woman, but your advice to her was the catalyst that pushed me to put my apartment on the market to sell. I am pleased to tell you that just last night, October 22nd, I signed the sales contract for my apartment in New York. We are aiming for November 14th as the closing date. It is an all-cash deal, and the buyer already, of course, gave 15% for the escrow account. My apartment had cost me $246,000 back in 1996. Now I sold for $900,000. I am writing to say thank you for your words, for your advice, and for being such a caring human being. Thanks to you, I do feel that I am going to be saved, just as you told Catherine that day of February the 11th. I am one of the people that was sorry to hear you were leaving us for 3 weeks, but totally understood that you have your own life, which has to include a holiday. However, let me say that today I was so very happy to know that you are back on the air and that I can count on a voice of reason and logic to educate me. Earlier today, I spoke to my daughter in Montreal, and I told her that I couldn't wait till 2 p.m. because you were going to be back on the air. Your talk this afternoon was most moving and made me sad. When you said that we had had a fine party and now we have to pay the price, a strange feeling came over me. This is indeed the death of a way of life and of the age of innocence. Hope your cold is better. Sincerely, Sarita Alitovsky. Well, Sarita, I really appreciate the heads up, the kind words. you know, it is very sad. I mean, many people who have had enormous gains on their property and have been counting, you know, on these properties for their retirement are now, of course, going to get a rude shock. And it is very gratifying to know that some people did see the light, did in fact liquidate their holdings, and will now, needless to say, not lose any money, because they will follow the advice and they will hold onto the cash that they have generated through the sale. You know, this is not difficult to do, ladies and gentlemen. If you have done these things in the past, if you have been good and been conscientious about your finances and economics, you will find this a doozy, because it simply is a question of the discipline of doing what you know in your heart you have to do. Well, I must say I've enjoyed talking to you today, ladies and gentlemen. I know that we have lots more to talk about, and I hope you enjoy hearing your fellow listeners' questions, because I enjoy reading them and answering them. But we are out of time, and I wish you all a very wonderful weekend, and I will be back with you again on Monday, as usual, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. This is Richard Martin, Richard Martin's Wake Up Call, saying bye-bye till then.